And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, we'll hear from the Occupy ICE protest in Southwest Portland.
We'll also update commuters on summer construction and delays.
And we'll bring listeners up to date on the Supreme Court vacancy.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, July 9th, 2018. I'm Zelis Marchant, filling in for Natalie Motti.
And I'm Ken Jones. Today, the Occupy ICE encampment in downtown Portland was attacked by Department of Homeland Security police. Demonstrators were maced, and two of them were arrested. I visited the site a little earlier and spoke with one of the occupiers.
Sure. Basically, I was in the middle of camp working on a garden when we started hearing that the DHS police officers were coming down the hill behind our camp, and people that have campsites back there were kind of worried about why they might be back there, so we started running down. And then we realized that they were actually moving towards our camp, so we decided to tell people to run in. Some people decided not to. Most did. And then we realized as soon as they were getting real close that we had to close our gate. We closed our back gate, and then they started to force their way in. So they pushed on our gate. They tried to top it over. We had enough people to hold it up and keep it closed. And then something happened behind them where they decided to arrest a female. And while she was on the ground, people were screaming and yelling, all that good stuff, because they were basically just, you know, testing us. They didn't have any reason to come down here. We've been peaceful since they've been here. And they needed action, so they decided to provoke it today. And they got what they wanted. They arrested two people and pepper sprayed a few of our people, about 7 to 10 maybe, and then some of their own people as well, caught some of it. Sure, they had to call fire or medic response to help their own people with pepper spray.
So two people got arrested by DHS officers?
So the second person, after they were trying to drag that person back up the hill, the first one, a car pulled up to have that person carried away. And there was a line of DHS officers towards the top of the hill, and we formed, not me personally, but a few of our people formed an arm lock wall. They just locked arms at the elbows. And then there was yelling back and forth. Some people in the arm lock were yelling, and some people around them were yelling. Eventually, one of the DHS officers decided to charge through the wall and tackle someone. That was the person that they tackled was the second person arrested. It was actually the third person total today, but the first person was earlier before they tried to walk through our camp.
And where do these DHS officers come from? So from what I understand, the Portland police aren't interfering, but they are bringing in DHS officers?
Sure, the DHS has like a protection force where they just protect federal buildings throughout the country. And some of them are here protecting this one.
And only two people were arrested, and you guys were maced?
Yeah, and their own people as well.
Mm-hmm. Apparently one of our people had to leave because they got maced.
Yeah, a KBOO person as well.
Yeah.
No, it's all right. Basically, he asked me what I thought people might be able to do, and I was telling him that contacting your representatives right now is the main thing, because the only thing that has this ICE building operating is a permit from the city from 2011 that allows them to operate that shouldn't, considering it's a sanctuary city. And then the lease, which is privately owned lease, which could be easily terminated. And enough public support could easily have either of those things terminated.
Mm-hmm. So there's still work to do
down
there.
The country as well, yeah. Before occupation movements need to even be started. You could just have your representatives take an action now.
Mm-hmm. And how are you all doing at the camp?
It's a little calmer now. Mm-hmm. We're tense because we thought we had permission to be here. You know, we were already kicked off of federal property and we're on city property now. So for them to just walk in and try to push their way through seemed like out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
They probably feel a little, sore because a city official came and told them that their fence wasn't handicap accessible. So they had to adjust their fence some for the sidewalk. And, you know, they got hurt about that. They got personal, I guess. And decided to just walk through our camp and see what we would do, and they got a couple arrests out of it. So they're probably happy about that.
Oh, wow. Is there anything else you'd like to tell us?
Personally, I saw people being told to back up from the car where people were being put into. Mm-hmm. And as they were backing up with their hands up, they were being maced. Holding a camera and filming, she had both her hands up, and she got maced with a gun that she was maceballed. And this is all recorded.
Mm-hmm.
Putting out videos now, I believe.
Okay.
One more thing.
Oh, yeah, please.
I don't know what DHS or ICE will feel like releasing, but they have three cameras on the side of the building that shows everything that happened.
Mm-hmm.
So they probably will try to keep that hush-hush, but people started recording as soon as they could, as soon as we realized something was happening. So
mm-hmm.
Here's the video. Here's the phone now.
Oh, great. Thank you so much.
That was a witness from the Occupy ICE PDX site on Southwest McAdam. That was recorded about 2 hours ago, as you've heard, after DHS agents invaded the camp unprovoked, apparently unprovoked. For more information, we actually have Teresa Mitchell of KBOO down at the Occupy ICE PDX camp. Teresa, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
And I met you there before I left. It seems like it's calmed down quite a bit since the DHS action about 3 hours ago.
Yeah, I would say so. It's returned to the state of calm that characterizes the camp. There's a guitar player out front, and people are kind of on the watch, though. There's a fraud atmosphere. There's a couple of people up on a barricade, and they're up at about, I guess they're elevated about 6 feet. So they're able to look south down Moody Street and observe the goings-on. There's a lot of going back and forth at the ICE compound, which is just to the west of the TriMet easement that's being used by the camp. And they're using binoculars and being careful. I'm hearing things going on. For example, I was talking to someone else who was acting as a journalist here, and she said that she saw some police a few blocks south talking with some person who evidently was packing a weapon. They asked him about it, and then they seemed to get along very well with that person. And so the conjecture here is that this person was with them, or was so okay with them that he can walk around with a gun around federal protective police.
And that person Teresa, that person was not in uniform? That was just street clothes?
That person was not in uniform, so we don't know, who that was. It was another man. Devin is here, and he has been getting his hands dirty putting in vegetables in the garden. And, I see a second guitar across the street. So this is, so the piece has returned for the moment to the camp.
Now, earlier, our KBOO technical person there, Nicholas, was pepper sprayed. So he left the camp. He's washing off his clothes. He was treated at the camp. I was told we did a few interviews after we did that audio with one of the witnesses, that the DHS agents actually pepper sprayed a few of their own. And they called ambulances and the fire department to treat them while there was medical facilities for the protesters. Did you have any follow-up on that? And there were also two people arrested. I haven't heard anything further. I think they're still being detained.
I don't know what the status is of the arrestees, but the people I've talked to confirm your story that the arrests were sudden, unprovoked, violent. And I think of it in terms of of a number of gestures that would indicate that they're reading out of the Army PSYOPs manual here, dancing in the windows with a costume of an eagle on, playing sudden loud music with foreboding lyrics, and these sudden arrests. I think they're trying to disrupt what is actually a relatively safe and peaceful scene here and try to give people the impression that it is otherwise. But I think, you're pretty safe. Any person would be pretty safe just coming down here and checking it out.
Yeah, in fact, I was down there on Friday. I talked to one of the hunger strikers, Bobby McMahon, and it was totally peaceful, actually very calm and quiet. There were five DHS agents blocking Sherman Street at the time with two DHS police cars, but they were actually not moving around. They were quiet. So it was quite a surprise that there was action today. I did hear some speculation, and maybe you heard some too. The witness that we heard mentioned that DHS was actually cited by the city of Portland for a violation, a code violation.
Yeah,
The fence there is not ADA accessible, and also it's blocking half the sidewalk. They speculated that kind of led to some frustration, and maybe they took it out on the protesters?
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, we can only speculate as to their motivations, but yeah, that's what I heard. He was down here in a reflective vest and put up an official notice.
Yeah, I guess we don't have anything more factual than that speculation, because DHS didn't say. But all I can say is that the city did not seem involved. There was no city police there. There was it's on TriMet property. They're okay with the protesters there. So we'll have to find out more. But Teresa, thanks very much for being there and bringing us the story.
Glad as always to be a part of KBOO.
And that was Teresa Mitchell at the Occupy ICE camp on Southwest McAdam. As we have more, we'll bring that news to you.
Federal courts are hearing the final appeals from several different groups about the EPA's controversial decision to not ban chlorpyrifos. For more on this story, KBOO reporter Summer Barraza has more.
Labor, civil rights, and health groups, and seven states are making their final arguments in court today, challenging the Environmental Protection Agency's decision not to ban a dangerous pesticide. The EPA had proposed to ban the pesticide chlorpyrifos, but former Chief Scott Pruitt reserved course when he took over the agency, saying science about the chemical's dangers was unresolved. Attorney Patty Goldman is with Earth Justice, which is representing the groups in this lawsuit. She disputes the agency's claim that the science isn't clear, saying there's a large body of evidence that the pesticide is dangerous, especially for children.
What's emerged in the last 20 years is incredibly solid evidence that this pesticide damages children's brains at very low exposures. Things like reduced IQ, autism, attention deficit disorder, every parent's fear.
Goldman says residue from this pesticide is on the food we eat, and that the country's strong food safety laws don't allow for people to be exposed to such a hazardous chemical. Oregon, California, and Washington are among the states challenging the EPA's reversal on chlorpyrifos. They'll ask the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals to overturn that decision. Goldman says Earth Justice is presenting arguments on behalf of farm worker groups nationwide, including Oregon Farm Workers Union PCUN, whose members have felt the effects of chlorpyrifos in the fields.
Our clients have members who have been poisoned by this pesticide and who have children with learning disabilities and who have had drift come to the schools where their children go to school. And they're terrified that they are exposed to this pesticide with all we know about it, and that our government is continuing to allow that to occur.
Goldman says many farm workers get triple the exposure to this pesticide. It's on the foods they eat and in the air and water where they live. The pesticide has been banned from home use for about 2 decades because of its dangerous effects. It's used on various crops, including apples, oranges, and broccoli. In conjunction with Oregon News Service and KBOO.FM, I'm Summer Barraza.
Scott Pruitt resigned last week as the head of the EPA. In conjunction with Oregon News Service and the KBOO Evening News, reporter Emmett White has more information.
After allegedly overspending on everything from pens to lavish trips and accepting questionable deals from lobbyists, government ethics and watchdog groups say Scott Pruitt's resignation as Environmental Protection Agency administrator is long overdue. During his one-year tenure, Pruitt was seen by many conservatives as one of President Donald Trump's most effective cabinet members, working relentlessly to dismantle Obama-era regulations aimed at reducing pollution. Stephen Spalding, with Common Cause, says Pruitt's questionable past was widely known, and his group had urged Congress to delay the confirmation when Pruitt withheld documents revealing corporate influence in his decision as Oklahoma Attorney General.
He was clearly unfit for the position of public trust that he was in as administrator of the EPA. I think we were extremely troubled that the majority in Congress really refused to hold him accountable and, in our view, were complicit.
Spalding says he has similar reservations about Andrew Wheeler, a former coal company lobbyist and now EPA deputy administrator, who will take Pruitt's place as acting administrator on Monday. Pruitt expressed no regrets in a letter submitted to media outlets on Thursday. Environmental groups predict the Trump administration will continue its pattern of appointing the least likely candidate to head the agency. Kara Cook Schultz is director of U.S. Purge's toxic program and thinks the president should take time to understand the purpose of the EPA.
He was clearly unfit for the position of public trust that he was in as administrator of the EPA. I think we were extremely troubled that the majority in Congress really refused to hold him accountable and, in our view, were complicit.
Like President Trump, Pruitt voiced skepticism about mainstream climate science. Andrew Wheeler also doubts that humans are a primary cause of climate change. In conjunction with Oregon News Service and KBOO.FM Evening News, I'm Emmett White.
As first reported by the Oregonian, the Avett Brothers were scheduled to perform a sold-out concert at Edgefield on Saturday. The concert was abruptly canceled when a man allegedly entered the venue with a gun. According to Willamette Week, the man in question set off a metal detector, causing security staff to investigate. Security suspected that the man was carrying a firearm, which is not allowed on Edgefield property. During the on-site investigation, security said the man claimed to be an out-of-state police officer and disappeared into the crowd before a manager could arrive. Crowd Management Services, the firm hired to provide security at the concert, said they contacted the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office when they could not locate the man. Police officers and security personnel swept the venue but could not find the suspect. Considering the turn of events, the producer for the Avett Brothers and venue staff decided that the show should be canceled. The Avett Brothers issued a statement on their website that said, quote, "Due to the obvious threat posed by someone in the audience with a firearm, regardless of his unconfirmed claim of being a member of law enforcement, we were obligated for the safety of everyone present to cancel the performance," end quote. Audience members have the option to attend a rescheduled concert or be reimbursed for their tickets. The Multnomah County Sheriff's Office is not currently conducting a criminal investigation concerning the incident at this time.
Starting yesterday, July 8th, ODOT closed down freeway ramps I-5 southbound to I-84 eastbound until early morning on July 23rd. However, more construction is to come, as this is one of Portland metro area's largest freeway construction projects and is set to last until mid-August. After July 23rd, drivers should expect another ramp closure from I-84 westbound to I-5 northbound at night, starting on July 25th, 2 days after the previous closure. The construction on those ramps are set to be done early morning on August 6th. Drivers will be getting a 10-day break after August 6th before another late-night ramp closure on I-84 westbound to I-5 southbound starting on August 17th. This closure is expected to be settled early morning on August 27th. Public transportation such as C-Tran will not have buses on both I-5 and I-84 interchanges on its journey to and from downtown Portland. Their express routes will be servicing the usual stops, but C-Tran is encouraging their riders to use TriMet's transportation services, such as the MAX, until construction stops, according to KPTV.com. The madness continues away from the steering wheel, as the Springwater Trail will also be closed, starting today, for restoration projects until October, increasing bike traffic in the area for drivers. Drivers are to expect delays and traffic on all freeways in the Portland area.
In the year 1963, East Coast couple Norma and Donald Bassist opened the Women's Only Bassist Fashion Institute in the Pearl District of Portland, a school that specialized in training students in different types of design such as interior and apparel, as well as retail management. By 1996, the Bassist couple sold their college, and it became one of the nearly two dozen art institute schools in the United States. Now, after 22 years, the Art Institute of Portland, a for-profit, four-year school, will be closing its doors on December 31st of this year. Portland's location won't be the only one closing down, as other art institutes and cities across the country will also be closing soon. Orange County, California, Denver, Colorado, and Detroit, Michigan are just a few of the cities where the art institutes will be closed. Portland Mercury quotes the Art Institute's international president, Claude Brown, in an email that was sent exclusively to Portland Art Institute students, saying, quote, this decision was made for a number of reasons, including a shift in student population on campus, end quote. Students of the Portland Art Institute are feeling left in the dust, but are being offered by the college a 50% tuition reduction remainder of the school year. The same tuition discount applies to students who decide to transfer and move to another art institute location. Seattle, Washington is the closest institute in the Pacific Northwest, followed by Hollywood, California, and San Diego, California. For students who decide not to attend any of the other Art Institute locations, they have the option of receiving a $5,000 voucher from the Institute. According to the Portland Mercury, the Portland Art Institute had enrolled nearly 700 students in the 2016 to 2017 school year. CollegeScorecard.ed.gov claimed that the Portland Art Institute's graduation rate is below 13% of the national median, in which the rate is about 29%. In retaliation to the Portland Art Institute shutting down, faculty from the college have banded together to start a GoFundMe in which 12 people have donated around $1,640 of their $2 million goal in 3 days. Donations range from the lowest being $15 to the highest being $500. On the GoFundMe page for the Portland Art Institute location, it claims that the $2 million is a rough estimate of how much it will cost to purchase the college from Dream Center Education Holdings, LLC, the company that owns the college. Besides buying back the college from DCEH, the staff and faculty from the Art Institute hope that, quote, this buyout is an attempt to have independence as a college and make the college the best applied arts college it can be, end quote. This quote taken from their GoFundMe page. The staff and faculty at the Portland Art Institute hope to reach up to $1 million before or on November 1st of this year in order to buy the college back from the LLC holding it. If the amount has not been reached by then, they said that they will promise to give the money back to the donors.
The landmark environmental case filed by a group of youth activists in 2015 now has an official court date. Their motions have all been denied, only succeeding in causing the original court date of February 5th to be moved to the new date of October 29th. The case, called Juliana versus the U.S., argues that the federal government has neglected the people's constitutional right to a hospitable global environment. It claims that the plaintiff's public trust rights have been violated due to the government's irresponsible resource management. Juliana versus the U.S. calls for reform encompassing many environmental issues, as well as calling for the overturn of specific environmental regulations, which would be unconstitutional under this precedent. Optimistic supporters are calling it the trial of the century. A success in court could potentially be a huge step towards effective climate reform, but until then, the Trump administration is determined to make sure the case fails. The government has already demonstrated they are doing what they can to halt and undo the progress of this case. However, the organization supporting it, our Children's Trust, has initiated a separate state-by-state effort by filing many other lawsuits towards the same effort.
President Trump is set to announce his Supreme Court nominee pick today, Monday, July 9th at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, filling the impending vacancy created by Justice Kennedy's retirement. According to the New York Times and Scotus blog, President Trump has narrowed his list of potential nominees down to 4 judges. President Trump's favorites have been identified as United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Judge Brett Kavanaugh and United States Third Circuit Court of Appeals Judge Thomas Hardiman by those involved in the discussions, according to the New York Times and the Washington Post. However, United States Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals Judge Amy Coney Barrett and United States Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals Judge Raymond Clethridge are also reportedly in contention. Standing out as one of the first to garner speculation, Brett Kavanaugh has a long and not able legal history, graduating from Yale Law School, serving under Kenneth Starr during his investigation into Bill Clinton, clerking for Justice Kennedy, and serving the District of Columbia Circuit Court of Appeals for 12 years. While Mr. Kavanaugh has been favored because of his professional conservative record, he has stated that he believes in upholding Roe v. Wade and that the Supreme Court has found the legal right to abortion on a number of occasions during his 2006 confirmation hearing. With views on abortion being a key factor, President Trump's nominee choice, Mr. Kavanaugh faces challenges from liberals and conservatives alike if nominated.
Thomas Hardiman, however, faces far fewer challenges from those of more conservative viewpoints, and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has pointed this out to President Trump. Hardiman graduated from Georgetown University Law Center with honors in 1990, and went on to private practice until 2003. In 2003, Hardiman was appointed by President George Bush to the U.S. District Court for the Western District of Pennsylvania, and was later appointed to the U.S. Third Circuit Court of Appeals in 2007. Hardiman holds a broad view of the Second Amendment, supports capital punishment, and is a vehement supporter of free speech, even arguing that a federal law criminalizing video depictions of animal cruelty should be struck down. Amy Coney Bryant, Barrett attended Notre Dame Law School, where she graduated summa cum laude and has gone on to be a professor of law at George Washington University and her alma mater, Notre Dame. Barrett clerked for former Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia in 1998 to 1999 and went into private practice until 2002 when she began teaching. In May of 2017, Barrett was nominated by President Trump to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals and was confirmed in a close vote on October 31, 2017. Barrett has been singled out by the SCOTUS blog as the most socially conservative of the potential nominees because of her pro-life abortion views and membership in Notre Dame's Faculty for Life. Raymond Kethledge stands out from the rest of potential nominees and lays his roots in similar soil to that of the small-town lawyer upbringing of Justice Kennedy. Kethledge completed his undergrad and law degrees at the University of Michigan, graduating second in his class from law school, and has spent the majority of his life in Michigan. After clerking for former Senator Spencer Abraham of the Senate Judiciary Committee and Justice Kennedy, Kethledge returned to private practice, along with working as an in-house counsel briefly for Ford Motor Company in 2001. Kethledge was nominated twice for the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals by President Bush before being confirmed on June 24, 2008. Similar to Barrett's views on the Constitution, Kethledge views the Constitution in an originalist nature and has been known to hold broad views of the Second Amendment, much like Hardiman.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with playwright Michael Bertisch and actor Diane Condren about their play, Adroit Maneuvers. At 6, it's Labor Radio. That's followed at 6:30 by Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low around 59 degrees, followed by partly cloudy skies and a high of around 80 degrees. East of the Cascades and Hood River, there will be clear skies and a high of around 84. Today in history, in 1979, Nazi hunters Sergei and Bate Claresfield survived an attempted assassination when their car blew up outside their home in France. In May of 2015, the couple was honored with the German Federal Cross of Merit for their work in bringing Nazi war criminals to justice. The quote of the day is from Haile Selassie. He said, quote, "Throughout history, it has been the inaction of those who could have acted, the indifference of those who should have known better, the silence of the voice of justice when it mattered most, that has made it possible for evil to triumph," end quote. The president of Nicaragua, Daniel Ortega, spoke publicly for the first time on Saturday since a political uprising began in early April. Ortega's Sandinista government has been accused of corruption and in the last 11 weeks is to blame for the deaths of what some human rights groups calculate is over 300 people by way of mass shootings of protesters, Molotov cocktailing civilian homes, and the disappearing of students and activists. After peace talks had been said to be in process, the unrest seemed to be lightening, but Ortega's speech 2 days ago crushed hopes of there being a peaceful solution. He blamed anti-government activists for the violence and declined to move elections to an earlier date, as was hoped by protesters. Since Ortega's armed pro-government gangs have been proliferating the streets throughout Nicaragua and with more force, only furthering the anti-government activists' resistance and fortitude, more deaths are sure to follow. Though Donald Trump's acknowledgement of the situation in Nicaragua has been scant, the U.S. has imposed sanctions on three Nicaraguan individuals believed to be connected with Ortega's violence and corruption.
Hiroshima, Okayama, Hyogo, and many more Japanese cities were flooded starting Thursday, June 5th. As the rain began on Thursday, it carried on into the weekend, raising the death toll to 103, according to CNN. The previous toll was at 90, but an additional 13 civilians passed away from cardiac arrest. The toll is still increasing. The flood tampered with natural resources such as rivers and created landslides, smothering those who were attempting to escape. The floods also destroyed vehicles and buildings along the way. 73,000 search and rescue groups are scouring the thousands of damaged homes, including homes with downed power lines, leaving the houses without electricity. Many who were unable or refused to leave took refuge on rooftops to wait for rescue crews to save them. around 1.6 million Japanese civilians have been evacuated. Kyoto officials are attempting to tame the flooding by using several dams in the area. Canceling his planned tour through France, Belgium, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt, the Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe said that he would focus on his country's relief from the natural disasters.
Last week, the World Cup round of 16 wrapped up with Sweden taking on Switzerland and England facing off with Colombia. Sweden and Switzerland proved to be well matched. The two sides slugged it out with both teams generating plenty of attacking opportunities. It took until the 65th minute for Sweden to find a breakthrough when Emil Forsberg's shot was deflected into the net, giving Sweden the 1-0 lead. Switzerland pushed hard for an equalizer, but it never came, sending Sweden to the quarterfinals. Later that day, England and Colombia battled it out in a great match. Although they met in the round of 16 on their side of the bracket, Colombia and England were both viewed as potential favorites to reach the final. Early in the second half, England striker Harry Kane was brought down in the box and England was awarded a penalty. Like he has done on numerous occasions during the tournament, Kane stepped up to the spot and finished calmly to bring England closer to the quarterfinals. Colombia, without injured star James Hamas Rodriguez, pushed desperately for an equalizer. After winning a corner in the 92nd minute, Colombia sent all 11 players into the England box in search of a goal. As he did against Senegal, defender Yerry Mina came up with the goods, heading the ball into the net to force extra time. The two beleaguered teams scrapped their way through extra time and had to go into penalties to decide the winner. England's Jordan Henderson had his penalty saved, but luckily for him, Colombia's Matheus Uribe smashed his shot off the crossbar immediately afterward. Colombia's fifth shooter, Carlos Bacca, had his shot saved impressively by England's Jordan Pickford. With only one penalty left, England's Eric Dier had the opportunity to send England to the quarterfinals of the World Cup. Dier stepped up and slotted his penalty calmly back into the net, booking England's ticket to the quarterfinals and sending Colombia home.
And now here's another installment of World Cup for the casual fan. After four gripping matches, the quarterfinals of the World Cup has come to a close. Quarterfinals saw Uruguay, Brazil, Russia, and Sweden get sent home, leaving only four teams standing. The four semifinalists need only two wins in order to be crowned World Cup champions. Tomorrow at 11 a.m., France takes on Belgium in the first semifinal. Of the four teams remaining, these two are seen as the biggest favorites to win the tournament, yet only one of the two teams will be heading to the final. After a slightly underwhelming group stage, France has been picking up steam, led by Antoine Griezmann, Paul Pogba, and Kylian Mbappe. The French side has a potent attack that can strike with lightning speed. Despite dispatching Argentina and Uruguay, France still looks like they have yet to reach top gear. If they're to beat Belgium, the French side will certainly need to find that gear. Belgium has put together a very impressive tournament. They've scored 14 goals and conceded only 5 in 5 matches. Those 14 goals have come from the tireless efforts of Romelu Lukaku, Eden Hazard, and Kevin De Bruyne. Despite their high-octane offense, Belgium has had some issues in defense. Their back line looked frail against Brazil, and at times, goalkeeper Thibaut Courtois was the only thing that kept Belgium in the game. With the attacking creativity and clinical finishing that France possesses, Belgium will need to find a way to tighten their defense. Belgium has not been afraid to tinker with their formation during the World Cup, and they may have to do that once again against France. Belgium fields only 3 defenders, and France plays with 3 strikers. To give themselves a chance, Belgium will have to find a way to reinforce their defense or they'll stand little chance. France needs to be fluid and move the ball with speed in order to succeed, and Belgium needs to find the feet of Lukaku, Hazard, and De Bruyne to trouble the French defense.
This Wednesday at 11 a.m., England and Croatia will face off in the second semifinal. Before the World Cup began, England was viewed as unlikely winners, and Croatia was seen as even less likely winners. Such is the unpredictability of the World Cup that now either England or Croatia will find themselves fighting for the trophy in the finals this weekend. England did well in the group stage and arguably lost against Belgium in the group stage on purpose in order to end up on this side of the bracket, where there were far fewer big teams to beat on the way to the final. Alternatively, Croatia completely dominated their group and found themselves in the fortunate position of landing on the weaker side of the bracket. Much to England's delight, Croatia was forced to play the 120 grueling minutes followed by penalties against a tenacious Russian team in the quarterfinals, leaving the Croatian players with less energy and less time to recover before the semifinals. England, on the other hand, dominated Sweden in the quarterfinals, winning 2-0 without having to expend too much energy. Fitness may play a role role in this match as the minutes tick by and the Croatian players become fatigued. But if there were ever a time to fight through the pain, it has to be now. This Croatian side is mentally tough and may just have what it takes to be the Cinderella story in the World Cup final.
Beyond their mental toughness, Croatia will need Luka Modric and Ivan Rakitic to be the creative force at attack. England's been stubborn defensively during this tournament, so Croatia may need a bit of magic to unlock England's defense. For England, they come into the match as the favorite, which isn't always a good thing. They'll have to forget the high expectations and play how manager Gareth Southgate has told them to, by having fun, being creative, and taking risks. This England side is far more fluid and enjoyable to watch compared to previous England teams. They have all of the tools to take down Croatia on Wednesday. Croatia will have to corral England's red-hot Harry Kane. They'll have to be strong on defensive set pieces, from which England has created quite a few goals this tournament. Croatia will be dangerous on the counterattack, and Modric has the ability to tear England apart if he's not closely watched. Croatia will need Modric to be on the ball constantly, creating opportunities to score. England will need to get the ball to Kane in front of the goal, where he almost can't help but score. Check in on Thursday for results from the semifinals and for a breakdown of the World Cup final, which kicks off next Sunday.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Yurok Tribal Court and the Superior Court of Humboldt County in California are collaborating on a new court. The state tribal joint jurisdiction will focus on youth and respond to the opioid epidemic. Starting this month, families involved in juvenile dependency cases will have the option to enter into the new court. Tribal and state officials say far too many tribal families are suffering from substance abuse-related issues. They hope the combined resource will help break the cycle of addiction and assist with child abuse and neglect cases. Officials have been working on the collaboration since October 2017. The tribe hopes it will serve as a model for other state and tribal courts in California and the nation. Choctaw Nation member Gavin Clarkson has been picked to be the Republican nominee for the Secretary of State in New Mexico, the Las Cruces Sun News reports. He was selected in secret ballot over the weekend by the Republican Party's State Central Committee to replace the candidate who recently withdrew from the race. Clarkson is a former congressional candidate and formerly served in the Trump administration in an Indian Affairs position. He'll face the Democratic candidate in the general election. Advocates are working with Native young people from across the country to address teen dating violence and teach about healthy relationships. Native women and girls recently took part in a Native Love Youth Track at the Women Are Sacred Conference in Albuquerque, New Mexico. 14-year-old Taylor Antone is a sophomore from Arizona who's Hopi, Tewa, and Tohono O'odham. She says the training will help her talk to peers back home.
Like, share with them the differences between healthy and unhealthy relationships, because there's a lot of, like, teen relationships, and tell them, like, if they're in an unhealthy relationship, to, like, help them, how they can get out of it and not to be scared.
15-year-old Kylie Hampton is from the Choctaw Nation in Oklahoma. The sophomore, who works with the Choctaw Youth Advisory Board, says she can relate to some of the issues being discussed.
I grew up in a house of domestic violence whenever I was younger, and I've had a lot of friends that have went through teen dating violence, and I've had a lot of friends that are LGBTQ that have went through bullying too, and I just hope to take back to my home that you don't have to do this to people, that they are just like everybody else, and that they need to feel loved too.
Marcia Ragland is Kylie's mother.
I feel like that our ancestors and everything have struggled so much, and we as women struggle on a daily basis to just be on an equal playing field with the men and everything in our jobs and in everyday life and everything, and I want her to grow up to be a strong and independent Choctaw woman.
Native Love is a youth project by the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center, which hosted the Women Are Sacred Conference. Advocates say it can inform their work with young people and promote youth-to-youth community relationship building. A Native higher education advocacy group and scholarship provider is standing by one of its scholarship recipients after an alleged racial discrimination incident at the Kim Kardashian West beauty brand pop-up shop in L.A. The American Indian Graduate Center says scholarship recipient Nicole Johnny, whose Navajo claims on June 30th she was told by a guard to get back in line or he would call and have her deported. Johnny also says the same guard asked to confirm if she was Mexican and further harassed her in the store. The American Indian Graduate Center is condemning the incident. Johnny is set to receive a master's in business administration from Pepperdine University next month and was visiting the LA area with her family when they attended the pop-up show. The beauty brand is reportedly investigating the incident. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. You can call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Summer Barraza, Emmett White, C.J. Fritz, Calvin Thompson, and Elizabeth Venable. Our producer is Grace Ann Smith. Our engineer is Mike Fotoklis. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Ellis Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Zelzelle Smarchant, filling in for Natalie Motley. At 7, coming up tomorrow on KBOO, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, the Abe and Joe Talk radio show covers politics, history, and the state of the zeitgeist with a liberal dose of listener commentary. At 9 on Alternative Radio, it's part 2 of a speech from Reed College in 1995, Howard Zinn and the book that changed the consciousness of a generation, A People's History of the United States. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, Stage and Studio, D-May features the last two shows of Coho Summerfest 2018, Embedded and Philip Glass's Menagerie. And at 11:30, Art Focus welcomes seminal activist and artist Danny Leon to talk about his films Willie and Murderers, showing this month at the Hollywood Theater. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by members and support just like you. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donates. Good night, Ken.
Good night, Zealous. Good night, Mike.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
On tonight's KBOO News In Depth, our guests are Diane Kondrath and Michael Bertis, speaking about the play Adroit Maneuvers, which is currently in production at Imago Theater just across the street from KBOO here on Southeast 8th and Burnside. The play, written by Michael, centers around a family conversation in New York City in the year 1966. The grandmother, named Tilda, revisits her youth of intellectual cafe culture in Vienna before Austria was annexed into Germany just before World War II. Diane, Michael, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you so much.
And thanks for coming in to talk about the play, our neighbors.
You bet.
Good to be here.
Michael, could you tell us a little bit about the play first, just a little background for the listeners?
Sure. The play has been described to me as epic, and it's a subject matter that has intrigued me for most of my life. It's the story of survivors of World War II, and it's centered on the story of the Anschluss in Vienna and people who witnessed what occurred with their country being invaded, how things fell, the quick overnight changes that occurred, how it impacted society very severely, and how quickly the flames of intolerance were fanned and people's lives were overcome. And the play itself takes place in 1996. Many years after this story took place, and it is the history of a grandmother who has never spoken of the past of these incidences because it causes a great deal of family strife and personal pain. And I have found through the years that a lot of people who experience this are very quiet about it. Like, it's overwhelming to them to speak of it. And so what happens in the interim of trying to rebuild your life, you find out how long PTSD of such a thing occurs and how intergenerational trauma transpires because people don't speak about it, and the hurts compound over time, and it causes a great deal of strife and dysfunction within families generations later. So in the effort to make peace with that, the main character, Tilda, played by Diane, takes it upon herself to open up about the past to her grandson, who's curious. And
Tilda lived through the Anschluss. Then, yes. How old was she during that
she
period?
She was in
from child.
From her 20s to 30s. There's a scene in the play that predates that, in the early teens. So epic, meaning it spans the course of many decades, and you see the character develop over time through these traumas, and then how they resonate later in life through her family.
Now, you mentioned you had been thinking of writing the play for a long time.
Yeah.
Why now? Are you seeing parallels in our current situation to pre-World War II Austria?
Yeah, I hear people talk about this subject a lot. And I'll give you a real quick overview of like the flashpoint for me that just made me push through it. And then this story has been in my mind for 30 years, and it was collected over, you know, many years of my life trying to piece together pieces of a puzzle, family issues and histories and things that I was aware of. And it wasn't until I heard a grandmother talk to me. And it was sort of out of the blue. I wasn't expecting this conversation to take place. And she just started weeping at me. It was unprovoked.
This was not your family. This
no.
was, how did this happen? A stranger?
It was somebody through work that I knew.
Okay.
And she started shivering and quivering and tearing up. And, you know, when you see somebody do that, you ask them, what can I do to help you? What's going on with you? And she was fretting and fretting. And she had just become a grandmother for the first time, and I don't really know her age, but I would assume it was between, you know, like around 60 years of age or so. And she was late being a grandmother, and she lamented the birth of her first grandchild because she felt that her grandchildren were going to inherit war and strife and pestilence and pain and nothing good, and that to see somebody go through that and declare the future to be unfortunate for somebody who's innocent, that would imprint on that child or any children in the future. And I thought to myself, I had to do something to address that as best as I could, because I witnessed these things in my own family, and I didn't want that woman's voice haunting me for the rest of my life. And I began to realize that a lot of people felt that way, and that collectively, globally, even now, when we're so connected around the world with information, that people fret about each and everything that happens, and collectively it causes some sort of depression. And hopelessness for the future is not something that I can personally abide. I don't think that is good for children. And you see children growing up with this embedded in them, and if you don't give them hope, it's like the war of the past continues on. We have to put that to bed. So Adroit Maneuvers is a play that attempts to tackle these things, and Diane does a magnificent job bringing the heart of the matter, the realness of the matter, third-dimensional reality of getting over this pain. And the main story discusses that the way that you do that is you have to let it go. You have to have compassion and understanding. You have to forgive. You have to be willing to let go of the past and not reinvent it, and be who you truly are.
Which is a great lesson for today.
Yes, exactly.
We're going through somewhat of a pessimistic time. I'm optimistic.
I think that would be an understatement.
I have friends who, yeah, I'll tell them I'm looking forward to November and all that, and all they can say to me is, I hope you're right. But they generally, the general mood seems to be pessimistic. Diana, I want to get to you. Obviously, Mikey, you did a lot of research, both historical and then talking with survivors of that era.
Yes.
People who actually lived through it and eyewitnesses. Diane, did you do some of that preparing for the role of Tilda?
I have played survivors of World War II and survivors of the Holocaust before, and so I've done a lot of research on that time period. I usually like to deal with what I have, the script in front of me, and then fill it in with research.
How do you do that? Is that actually interviewing people, or
and pictures too. I mean, there's a lot of information comes in through your eyes, comes in through words, comes in through images. So that time period is very alive for me. I steal from my own grandmother, who has a wonderful accent that I'm a little in fear of losing.
Where is she from?
She's from Ukraine.
And was she there during World War II?
She came over by herself when she was 16 years old. Actually, my grandfather's passport says Austria on it from where he came from. So they are not far from being my people. And the time of the Holocaust and the Anschluss has been a hot button topic for me, like for many people. You know what Mike is saying about having this trauma of bad things coming. Frankly, my whole life, I've been afraid of soldiers at the door. When people say, "How's your day going?" And I was like, "No soldiers at the door today." And maybe that's a little odd because I've had people say to me, "Oh, actually, my acting teacher, who's Jewish, said to me, you know, the only other person who says that is my husband, and he was raised by Holocaust survivors." So for whatever reason, it's a time period that's very alive for me. And I know that I've heard from neurologists that if you're afraid of something and you're able to actually say in words what you're afraid of, that your brain reorganizes itself and helps you to understand things better. But if you never tell your story and you keep it inside, your brain is always trying to go, what's going on, what's going on, what's going on? So, you know, this situation gets to come to life not just for Tilda, but I think for audience members.
And I can tell you from what I've witnessed, you know, I go to the play every night. I'm invested in it personally, emotionally, spiritually, however. It's very, very important to me, and I wanted it to be heartfelt and real. And I can honestly tell you, people walk up to me after the play just weeping and thanking the cast and the crew and the staff for putting the story on, and say how important it is and how revealing it is and how healing it is. And it's a dense play. It has a lot of drama in it. And they're all real stories. I mean, this is not just made up stuff. This is people really suffering. And when I think about the level of detail in this production, for example, our sound designer, Richard Moore, took actual soliloquies that were recorded of Holocaust survivors and turned them into sound effects in the background so that the vibration of these people's voices is peppered throughout the play. It means a lot when you know that that level of concentrated detail is there to support the vision. And the vision is, you know, forgiveness, compassion, understanding, standing up to intolerance. And one of the main themes is standing by and doing nothing while you watch these things going on is what creates and feeds the beast. And small acts of resistance and overturning your desire to run and look the other way and do nothing and do what you're called to do, to say no more to intolerance and to survive however you need to, that is what causes change, and that's what we really need, and that's really why the play was written.
And this is the world premiere, I should mention, yes, at Imago. The first night was Friday?
We had a preview night last Thursday, So we're now entering our second week.
And these are reactions you've gotten just over the past few days then?
Yeah.
But it must be exceptionally rewarding for you to get they're broken up, but in a very positive way. You've kind of gone past a barrier there, it seems,
yeah,
with the play. I mean, that all great art does that.
It's kind of strange to sit at a desk for 3 to 4 years trying to crank this puppy out. And it was difficult material. I was actually afraid of writing it because of how intense it was, and yet I knew it needed to be written. The timing of it is quite strange. Everybody who sees it, this is such a timely piece. We really need to be thinking these ideas right now. and it gives people hope. And I wasn't prepared for the level of response of heartfelt thanks and gratitude, and that it just makes people just open up, and it makes them think about their own families and makes them think about what they can do to make a difference, what small little thing they could do to stand up and say, no more of this. And because we just can't allow monsters to flourish, and a monster can't flourish all by themselves. It takes people to feed it.
How did you balance those themes of hope when it's not a scientific method for success? But we talk about it all the time, especially these days when it's, in my opinion, going kind of beyond pessimism, because there are very real traumatic things happening to people every day. So how did you walk that tightrope, actors and directors, to hold that safe space of hope that we need so much when we're in trauma, and then making action from that?
Well, I think a lot of that rests with the interpretation of the actors, because they read the script and all of them resonated to it instantly and said they were all supportive of it. And they all said, this is a message we need to stand behind. The theater community needs to support this message. All boats float together. The production basically is the message that I got from that. And so they entered the rehearsal process with that in mind. And we did our best to create a safe environment in the rehearsal hall, full of love and light. And that's how we got through it all. Just courage, commitment, conviction, and professionalism. And I couldn't say enough about the actors in this play. They are top rate. And the heartfelt message wouldn't come through without them. Diane here just blows the socks off of people. She has it's a very difficult role. She has complete and total command of the stage at all times.
Well, Michael, how can our listeners find out more about the play and get tickets and all that? And you've got another few weeks you're playing, right?
Yeah,
until the 22nd, is it?
Yes, we close July 22nd. Performances are Thursdays, Fridays, Saturday nights at 7 p.m. And then there's a matinee on Sundays at 2. And we have a website, adroitpdx.com, adroitpdx.com. There's a little button there you can click. We have a website that's connected there where tickets can be purchased online, or you can buy tickets at the door.
It seems like just a very important experience in addition to the entertainment, just the kind of the powerful release that people get from the play, I think.
Yes, I'm astonished that people are so touched, and I'm grateful, and that's all we wanted to accomplish.
Well, we've been talking about Adroit Maneuvers, which is currently in production at Imago Theaters, so that's Southeast 8th and Burnside. As Michael said, they have a website. There's also a Facebook page. You can come down and see our guest, Diane Kondrat, in the lead role as the grandmother, Tilda, and the writer, Michael Burdish. Thanks very much for coming into KBOO this evening.
Thank you so much.
KBOO hosts a monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater called KBOO at the Clinton. This month, we'll screen the film Behemoth on Thursday, July 12th at 7 p.m. Behemoth is a Chinese documentary showing the dehumanizing impact of coal mining. After the film will be a discussion on clean energy alternatives. Again, that's a film screening of the documentary Behemoth, Thursday, July 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio and the Jazz Society of Oregon are proud to present the 38th Annual Cathedral Park Jazz Festival, July 20th, 21st, and 22nd at Cathedral Park in North Portland. New this year, KBOO will broadcast the Friday Night Blues starting at 5 p.m., and Saturday's live broadcast will begin at 2 p.m. That's the 38th Annual Cathedral Park Jazz Festival.